the news and issues from a superior point of view.
They've been called musicians that resonate the soul of the Iron Range.
Eyes are heavy, but I just can't sleep.
We'll catch up with Morning Bird.
Never did me good trying to count all them sheep.
But first, a mellow pop in circumstances heralded in the Northland College commencement last year.
I don't think this happened yesterday. I don't think you lose $12 million in 6 months.
That commencement may have been the school's second to last. We'll speak with the college's president and others about Northland's possible closure. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. After 132 years, Northland College in Ashland may close. On Tuesday, administrators of the private liberal arts college that specializes in environmental education issued a statement saying that unless they could raise $12 million by April 3rd, the semester ending in May would be its last. The statement said the college does not have sufficient resources or the financial stability to continue current programs and operations beyond this academic year. The announcement sent shockwaves to students, faculty, and the larger community surrounding the campus, but administrators and trustees say they haven't given up hope, even if few other colleges around the country have succeeded with similar appeals. We'll talk about those with a reporter from Inside Higher Ed and also speak to a local parent of a junior who's on the soccer team at Northland. But first, we'll hear from the college's president, Chadwick Dayton. He's been president of Northland College since January 2023. He previously served on the college's board of directors beginning in 2015 and was named chair in 2018. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio, Chad Dayton.
Thank you, Robin. Thank you for the invitation.
So I would assume that the financial adversity hitting the college didn't materialize overnight. Was this something that you were aware of as the board chair before becoming president, or were there warning signs?
Northland has always been a small school and tuition reliant and reliant on a number of dedicated donors and a supportive alumni donor base. But the headwinds that face higher ed broadly, Northland is not immune to them. Mm-hmm. And over the course of the last 7 years or so, declining enrollment, not unique to Northland, and increased costs generally from an operational perspective, have put the institution in a position to have to rely on its endowment as a resource to support general operations. And over the course of all of this time, all of Northland's 132-year history, to be honest, you know, every decision has been made with the intent of providing the Northland experience and a Northland education for as many students as possible, and that remains true today.
Mm-hmm. And I do understand endowment. A lot of people don't, that you don't really want to touch an endowment for operating. So when you do, though, there's not much choice, correct?
You use the resources that are available to you to work through times of challenging times.
Right. So what does it mean for the students if the closure happens? Will this semester be it, or will there be another semester or two to help them round out their studies or prepare for transferring somewhere else?
The institution and Northland's dedicated Board of Trustees have made the commitment that Northland will continue its regular academic and other operations through this academic year, including Honors Day, which is a celebration of our students' work and their next steps in life and commencement. And we have an experiential May term, which provides lots of opportunities for students to be out in the field, in the water, in the woods, and traveling across the country. And we will complete a May term and have a commencement regardless of the outcome of this financial appeal. Obviously, there's a priority on taking care of our students, all of our people, but students are the reason that we're all here. And part of the identification of the April 3rd deadline for the financial appeal is to allow enough time for and with support for our current students and our prospective students to navigate the path of teach out or transfer so that they can find appropriate institutions for each of them to complete their educational career.
Are there any particular challenges for international students who may have visa issues if they can't immediately transfer to another institution?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. What about the community at large? There would likely be some ripple effect on the local economy. Again, was there any opportunity to give an earlier warning to the community?
Initial community outreach coincided shortly in advance of the statement to our campus community. Obviously, this is a consequential announcement, not just for Northland and its broad alumni base, but for our local and our regional community. Tremendous outcry of support and willingness to participate in all ways in order to make this fundraising initiative successful and secure a future viable Northland College.
How optimistic are you?
Both myself and the board would not have embarked upon this financial appeal if we did not believe that there was a possibility of success.
Mm-hmm. Is there perhaps another institution that might step in and acquire the college or some of the programs? And, you know, as you mentioned, that you're so much in the environmental sphere and really a niche, I would really think that would be attractive to some institution.
We are a very special institution and embody the environmental emphasis throughout our entire curriculum. Obviously, the priority right now, the singular focus right now, beyond taking care of our students, faculty, staff, and community, is to be successful in this financial appeal. It is too early to comment on what other options for the institution may be after that.
A best case scenario, if you do have to close, what would be the best case scenario of it?
If the institution is put in a position to have to announce closure, again, we are committed to completing this academic year and commencement. At that point, the institution would formally close somewhere around the end of its fiscal year, which is June 30. And then there are a number of pieces of our campus. We have a variety of centers, the Sigurd Olson Environmental Institute, established in the early 70s. The Mary Griggs Burke Center for Freshwater Innovation provides an incredible opportunity for experiential and applied research for our students on Lake Superior and on inland lakes and waterways.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's too early to comment or provide a lot of clarity, but there are other ways that a Northland could look should this not be successful. But we are all fully committed to finding a way to continue Northland as a degree-granting institution of higher education.
Any other thoughts or messages you want to convey?
No, I appreciate the opportunity. This is a very special institution with tremendous impact, both locally, regionally, and globally, as we've emphasized environmental focus over the last 50 years. Tremendously supportive alumni base spread far and wide. And we're very hopeful that we are going to be able to persevere as a college.
All right. We've been speaking with Chad Dayton. He's the president of Northland College in Ashland, which announced this week it may have to close if it does not raise $12 million by April 3rd. Thank you for joining us, President Dayton.
Thank you very much for the opportunity, Robin.
We now speak with Lynn Olson of South Range. Her son Jeffrey is in his second year at Northland College, although he's technically a junior, majoring in geology and also a member of the soccer team. Lynn Olson, what are his plans for next year?
Well, you know, he's begun looking at other options for himself. He is prioritizing his education. We obviously have to do that. We're not in a financial situation to just worry about soccer. So he's looking to finish the degree that he started. He's looking into geology and an environmental science type degree, which is why he went to Northland. He's exploring those other options and seeing what's available as far as credit transfer. They haven't heard anything from the school with regard to if the school has reached out to other institutions to get some grace with this credit transfer or not. They haven't heard anything like that yet.
Right. Northland specializes in environmental and, as you said, you know, outdoors and in geology. Not every place does, so you can't just go anywhere with that.
Yes. Yep. He has a pretty limited, and he knew that he wanted to do something along those lines, which again is why he even considered Northland. So he had a few other schools on his list at the time. So those are the ones he's revisiting first.
Mm-hmm. What about the soccer program?
Well, the soccer program turned out to be just beyond our wildest expectations. He was very blessed with a team that became like a family. So in that aspect, for all of those boys, is heartbreaking. It just is. They are so close, just like a family. And it's really, really just gut-wrenching for them. But two of the schools that he is looking at don't have soccer programs, UMD being one of them. UMD has a club team. They don't have a regular soccer team, and whether he would play on the club team or not remains to be seen. But there's a couple other schools that have, one has a startup and then one just doesn't have a soccer program. So, I think that's a piece of his life that he is wishful that he could continue, but yet I don't know how important it is to him, because I think this team just meant so much to him. I don't know if he could replicate that somewhere else.
What sort of notice you think would be appropriate, you know, for your sons? Should they have given some kind of warning a little bit earlier?
Well, I guess the way I look at it is, you know, Finlandia closed, I believe, not this past year, but the year before. And we actually did get a player on the soccer team from Finlandia that his school closed. And I believe it was a similar circumstance, right? It closed in the spring, so they knew there would be no fall. What I feel like is, first of all, I don't think this happened yesterday. I don't think you lose $12 million in 6 months. I think they had to have known earlier. Again, my son this is only his second year there, and we visited the school in 2021. They said they were debt free. Well, you know, I mean, how could they have possibly been? Maybe they were and they spent $12 million over budget in 2 years. I don't know the answer to that. But we did ask that question, and we're told that the school was debt free.
Right.
So I guess I feel like it with regard to the situation that, first of all, I think the parents and the students should have been notified other than a Facebook post. And we didn't get an email till a full 24 hours later, and like an individual email that basically said the same thing as the Facebook post. So it was kind of redundant. And the students themselves, I think there have been a few meetings where the school, my son wasn't at the meeting yesterday. He was at his soccer practice where they were kind of trying to decide what some of the players were going to do. But it sounds like the college has decided to discontinue athletics in the future, but there hasn't been anything in writing to us as parents. Like, what is the future plan? Like, if you raise the money, what is going to happen at the school? And that's what I think would be appropriate for, even for the donors. Like, if I was in a position to donate, I don't want to hear, oh, if we don't raise the money, we will just use the money that you give to transition students. That's not a, you know what I mean? That is not a reason for someone to donate. I think they should have had a plan and announced what that plan was when they made this announcement.
All right. We've been speaking with Lynn Olson of South Range. Thank you for joining us, Lynn.
Yep, thank you.
Northland isn't the only college seriously considering closure. Nationwide, a dozen or so do so each year. Josh Moody is a reporter for Inside Higher Ed who covers college closures, including a few others in Wisconsin. He speaks to us from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio, Josh.
Thank you for having me.
So a little bit about your beat. I know you don't just cover college closings, but there seem to be enough to keep you busy. How frequently do they close, and is there an uptick since the pandemic?
Yes. Yeah, so this is something I have written quite a bit about. It seems that closures are trending up. Typically, there are about 10 a year. And when I say 10 a year, I'm thinking of four-year nonprofit colleges specifically. But last year, there were 14 four-year nonprofit institutions that announced closures, but really 15 with an asterisk because there was one that closed, never formally saying that it closed, but with some plans to potentially reopen one day down the road, which is frankly difficult to do. Mm-hmm. And if I could just add on the for-profit side, which I admittedly don't track as closely, there were, I believe, 16 for-profit colleges that closed last year as well.
Mm-hmm. And when they do close, as you know, it's not just self-contained within the college. I imagine it affects the local economy, especially places like, Northland College is in Ashland, a kind of small town.
Sure. Effects can be devastating for communities, depending on how important of an economic engine that institution is. Students are often a major driver of local business, especially in small towns. Faculty and staff also contribute quite a lot, and students may just be there for 4 years, but faculty and staff may be looking to buy homes, put down roots. So it's multifaceted. Hmm.
The announcement by Northland College pretty much came as a surprise, well, to us and to the region. What are the warning signs, and when should trustees tell the community there's a potential problem?
Sure. Northland really checks all the warning signs. The profile that emerged of college closures that I've tracked has been private, tuition-dependent institutions with meager endowments that have seen enrollment declining for years and have been unable to recover from those sustained losses. And Northland hits every one of those. So you also have the accreditation component. The Higher Learning Commission, which accredits Northland, has raised concerns about its finances going back to at least 2010, according to the HLC website. And there's limited information posted on their site, but HLC has been on them about finances since 2010. So it's been a known problem. As far as when trustees should be straightforward with the community about the problems they're facing, probably before you get to a desperation fundraising plea. I think you need to make changes before that point and just be transparent with your community before you reach that point, because this is a very difficult position to fundraise from.
Are there, in fact, stories where somebody has made a desperation plea and they did get the funding, a benefactor arose and said, okay, we'll take care of it?
Not in this way. There have been pleas for partnerships that I've seen where another institution may step in with a merger or frankly an acquisition if they want the land and absorb that campus, some faculty and staff, and students who want to transfer over. So there have been those examples. The closest comparison to what is happening at Northland now is probably what happened at the King's College last year. I mentioned there was a closure with an asterisk. That is King's College in New York City. They have essentially closed, but never said they were closing. But basically, in early 2023, the King's College tried to raise $2.6 million for similar reasons over a few weeks. They only raised $178,000 by their deadline, which they then said was an artificial deadline, and continued to try to fundraise. They were not successful. And it's important in this day and age for colleges to have some kind of selling point, some kind of niche. And they had it. They were an evangelical college in the heart of New York City. And they still couldn't get it done, despite having some pretty major donors in the past that they had lost in recent years. So the closest comparison I have is the King's College, and that is not a very optimistic comparison.
Should we be upset for not hearing about this earlier? And I don't want to demonize anyone, but the warning signs would have been there.
Sure. They're a private college. I always want to see more transparency from institutions. Public institutions have some built-in transparency just by what is required by state law, but private institutions have a lot more flexibility to not be transparent. And I think there should always be more of it. That's me speaking as a reporter. I always want more transparency. So I don't think they've done anything unreasonable or out of the norm from how other private colleges have approached this. I think they probably should have done it sooner, but they are not doing anything that other colleges in this position haven't done or wouldn't do.
We're speaking with Josh Moody of Inside Higher Ed. We're talking about college closures in light of the potential shutdown of Northland College in Ashland. You covered a couple others, or at least one other recently in Wisconsin, the University of Wisconsin-Platteville Richland campus. And then also, if you haven't gotten it yet, there's been an announcement UW-Milwaukee's Waukesha campus will close in 2025. And we will disclose that Wisconsin Public Radio is a part of the University of Wisconsin. So how do these closures with little notice affect students?
So the effect for students can be really, really devastating. Now, it depends on how the closure is handled. I would say there are responsible closures and irresponsible closures. And the difference there is coordinated versus abrupt. A coordinated, well-thought-out closure is going to have a time frame attached to it, usually at least minimum of a semester, usually a year. And a responsible college will build teach-out plans that should allow students to fully transfer credits elsewhere. You know, credit transfer isn't always seamless, but institutions are often a little more flexible here. One big concern, though, is that students don't always re-enroll after their college closes. And that can, you know, it can be difficult for those students to start over. And it can be difficult for them to find the right programs, find programs that sync up with what they were trying to do at their original institution. So that is a challenge.
I've seen some social media posts joking, great, now I don't have to pay my student loans. Is that just a joke or is there some truth to that?
That is probably a joke, but there could be some truth to it depending. The depending part is basically if you have been defrauded by a college, you might get your loans forgiven by the government. I see no argument here that Northland has defrauded anyone. They, like a lot of other private institutions, simply ran into financial issues. I certainly don't think they recruited students knowing they were going to close, and they didn't seemingly recruit them under false pretenses. So I think those students are still on the hook for their loans.
I'm going to deem the worst case scenario as what we're dealing with, or hopefully they do avoid it. I mean, it hasn't happened yet. But what's the best case scenario? Given if there is a closure, what is the best case scenario?
Sure. If there is a closure, I think the best case scenario is that they have about a year off ramp, which allows them to get the seniors graduated, put robust teach-out plans in place, and help students transfer out. I think that is probably the best case scenario if there is a closure. Now, the college will tell you the best case scenario is we don't close, we raise the money.
Right. Well, let's hope that, you know, we want to be optimistic with them. We've been speaking with Josh Moody of Inside Higher Ed. Thank you for joining us, Josh.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, could you call their music taconite twang? We catch up with Morning Bird.
Dig a hole in the meadow. Dig a hole in the cold, cold ground. Dig a hole in the meadow.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Wouldn't it be great to head out west, then work your way back home, picking up gigs along the way, doing something you're really good at and getting paid for it, and then compiling all that work in a collection? That may not work if you're a doctor or a plumber, but it did for Morning Bird. The folk American trio from the Iron Range did just that last fall, and the result is their upcoming debut album, Echoes in the Meadow. They'll be premiering it at Wusel's in Duluth next month, but they're also performing at Ursa Minor Brewing in Duluth tonight. Jill Burks and Rob Wheeler are two-thirds of that trio, and they're with us now. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio, Jill and Rob.
Hey, hi, Robin. Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Robin.
So, Jill, you're on guitar and violin. Rob, you're on lead guitar, harmonica, and a few other instruments. And the third is Josh Palmy on upright bass, and all of you are vocalists. The Iron Range Tourism Bureau called you musicians that resonate the soul of the region through their music. Are you all from the range?
Yeah, we are. I'm originally from Hibbing, and I lived in Duluth for a short time during college, but am back here in Hibbing. And Josh is in Hoyt Lakes and graduated high school there and still lives there. And Rob, you can answer yourself.
I am a transplant. I just live here. I'm not from here, but I am a Minnesotan. I've traveled all around, and for the longest time, I called Crane Lake, Minnesota, my home, where I like the lake and the woods.
Well, we have a few lakes and woods on the range. Brianne Marie of Brianne Marie and the Front Porch Sinners calls her music Great Lakes Country. I'm wondering, with this Iron Range thing, is yours taconite twang?
Ooh, that's a good one.
I like that, actually, because I really, when people ask what's your genre, that's a box sometimes that's hard to be put in. So maybe we should start saying that. I like it.
I think so, yeah.
Well, that's the idea of Great Lakes Country, because if somebody doesn't like country, she says, oh, no, it's Great Lakes Country. Oh, okay.
Right, right.
And who doesn't like the Great Lakes? And who doesn't like taconite,
yes,
right?
Absolutely.
How about Morning Birds? Where does the name Morning Bird come from?
Rob and I started playing together as a duo in 2018, and we did not have a name. We always went by
Rob and Jill.
Rob and Jill.
They said, you can't call yourself that. You need a band name. So,
yeah. A lot of people were giving us heck for quite a few years, and finally we settled on Morning Bird. A friend of ours suggested it, and it just had a nice ring to it, and
feels good.
It felt good. I thought it didn't sound too rock and roll at the time. We were just a duo, acoustic duo. I thought it felt like a nice acoustic duo name. And now that we have Josh and Rob added the stomp box, we definitely have more of a band sound and with the low end, but I love the name Morning Bird. And
well, you're not going to get any complaints from this Robin. So let's hear some of your music. How about Dig a Hole in the Meadow? That sounds kind of rangy. Can you tell us about that?
So on our album, there are three traditional songs that we sing, and one of them is Dig a Hole in the Meadow, also known as Darlin' Corey. It's an old traditional tune that Josh actually brought to us when he joined the band. He's been with us for a year now, and we just loved the way that we arranged it and how we all sounded together, and we just thought we had to put it on the album. So it's one of our favorites.
All right. Well, here is Dig a Hole in the Meadow by Morning Bird.
Dig a hole in the meadow, dig a hole in the cold, cold ground. Dig a hole in the meadow, gonna lay darling Corey down. Wake up, darling Corey, what makes you sleep so sound? The revenue officer's coming, gonna tear your still house down. Dig a hole in the meadow, dig a hole in the cold, cold ground. Dig a hole in the meadow, gonna lay darling Corey down. Last time I saw Corey, she was standing on a bank by the sea, with a .44 buckled around her and a banjo on her knee. Dig a hole in the meadow, dig a hole in the cold, cold ground. Dig a hole in the meadow, gonna lay darling Corey down. Mm-hmm.
Hey, darling Corey, quit hanging around my bed. Liquor has ruined my body. Pretty women gone to my head. Dig a hole in the meadow. Dig a hole in the cold, cold ground. Dig a hole in the meadow. Gonna lay darling Corey down. Wake up, darling Corey, and go and get my gun. Ain't no man for trouble, but I'll die before I run. Dig a hole in the meadow. Dig a hole in the cold, cold ground. Dig a hole in the meadow. Gonna lay darling Corey down. Lay darling Corey down. Lay darling Corey down. Lay darling Corey down. Lay darling Corey down.
And that was Dig a Hole in the Meadow by Morning Bird. They'll be appearing at Ursa Minor Brewing in Duluth tonight, March 15th, which is the Ides of March. Is this an Ides of March concert?
This is just a concert for fun. We love playing at Ursa Minor. We love Duluth, but I don't know about the Ides of March.
Rob, anything that we have to beware of?
Just that we're coming to town, ready to have a good time.
There you go.
Okay. Well, you just mentioned that Dig a Hole in the Meadow is from the new album. Are you featuring songs from the album before the drop?
Yes, we have been. We've been playing these songs as we've written them this summer, slowly adding them into our set list, and just it's really fun to play them out and to see friends and family and fans start learning some of the lyrics and singing along. We've been enjoying that a lot.
And then they'll be able to buy it and have it anytime they want.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, I believe that Josh was the vocalist on Dig a Hole in the Meadow. Let's hear one with you, Jill, as the vocalist. How about Birds and the Bees? And do I dare ask what that is about?
Well, this was an upbeat song that I wrote at the request of my mom, because some of my songs earlier were kind of slow and melancholy. So that was part of it. But this is more of the idea of living free, not worrying about the 9-to-5 or bills, trying to be more like birds and bees and just living for the moment, being carefree on the road, making music with my friends. And yeah.
Okay, I'm going to go with that, especially since you said you wrote it for your mom.
It's safe, yeah.
Yeah, so here is Birds and the Bees by Morning Bird.
Fire, but I can't stand the
And that was Birds and the Bees by Morning Bird. They'll be appearing at Ursa Minor Brewing in Duluth tonight, March 15th, and not far away at Luke's Tavern in Bewabik on Saturday. And their album release concert will be at Woosel's in Duluth next month. Where can we learn more about your music?
You can find us on all the online sites. If you just Google Morning Bird or throw in the word Morning Bird, it'll come up sooner if you use it one word, Morning Bird, without a space in between it. Our website is www.morningbirdsings.com, and that has all our links there as well.
All right. About one more to take us out. Time for a Change. You want to set that up?
That was a song I wrote a few years ago, being really frustrated with the way things are. And probably this November, it will really ring true, too. Just being tired of the way we have very old politicians running the show and lots of corporations that have their hands in that too. And I kind of felt it was time for a change. We need to think with our hearts and open our minds, and also maybe a prerequisite to being a politician is you have some little psychedelics in your history to know what's going on in the world.
Open up that heart space, huh, Rob?
Yes.
Well, not to make any political commentary here, I'll just say your time for a change wish didn't happen. You got the same two guys running again.
That's fine. I'm a protest singer, Robin. It's really time for a change.
All right. I think I did just say something political, but we're going to just stop it right there. We've been speaking with Jill Burks and Rob Wheeler of Morning Bird. They'll be appearing, along with Josh Palmy, by the way, the third, at Ursa Minor Brewing in Duluth tonight, March 15th, and not far away at Luke's Tavern in Bewabik on Saturday. And their album release concert will be at Wusso's in Duluth on April 13th. Thank you for joining us, Jill and Rob.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Old man politician, not my choice. Old man politician, we need a new voice. Well, there's war in other countries, and I bet you're making money. Corrupt police and riots in the streets, and I don't think it's funny. There's children in school, what are we teaching them? If we want peace, we gotta change your curriculum. Life lost, what's the cost? Y'all worried about inflation. Or what's the price at the gas station? Has it hit $5? And all the news on TV, yeah, propaganda sucks. And it's time for change. Modern thinkers, psychedelic linkers, ayahuasca drinkers. Take us to our hearts and don't be afraid. Show us what we need to know. There's more of us than them. Why do they think they're in control? Billboards, TV, and the radio. All agendas and programming slowly erased in your soul. I got wrinkles on my face, feel like I'm getting old. One thing that I know for sure, I don't like doing what I'm told. And I don't wanna call you out and tell you you're not right. But if you don't listen, we're gonna stand up and love. 'Cause it's time, time for change.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and we're joined by Rick Lubbers of the Duluth News Tribune. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Robin.
And Maria Lockwood from the Superior Telegram. Hello, Maria.
Hi, Robin.
So, Rick, Cargill is one of the biggest food producers in the country. Now a member of that family is becoming the biggest property owner on Park Point, and there are concerns they may price locals out.
Yes, there are. Agents acting on behalf of the Cargill family continue to acquire property on Park Point at a pace that has drawn the attention of neighbors and folks at City Hall as well. Mayor Roger Reinert wrote a letter to billionaire Kathy Cargill on February 8th asking to discuss her plans for several properties that she and her representatives have recently purchased on Park Point, which has led to the removal and emptying of multiple homes in the neighborhood. But it elicited no response. And the buying spree has continued with upward of 20 properties now sold to the Cargills. So now Reinert hopes to enlist the support of city councilors to amplify his request for better lines of communication. He's invited Councilor Roz Randorf as the district council representative and four at-large councilors to join him on a follow-up letter that will hopefully get a better response. Randorf said the city has been working hard to increase its housing inventory, and the prospect of moving backward seems disheartening. Reinert acknowledged the Cargills have no obligation to share their plans with city officials and are fully within their rights to buy and sell property at will for whatever price they see fit. But the one thing remains non-negotiable. Park Point will not become a gated community. He said the beaches, the roads, and water accesses are going to remain public no matter who is buying what. The city will protect the rights to public access to both the bay and the lakeside. Don Buck, who's the president of the Park Point Community Club, said folks can't be faulted for selling their properties for top dollar, but the neighborhood remains uncertain what the future holds. Buck said Park Point homes recently have sold for nearly double their assessed value, and there are concerns about the potential tax implications for other property owners going forward. Reinert said he and city staff intend to maintain an open-door invitation to the Cargills to discuss their plans for the property they have acquired in Duluth thus far.
All right. Well, on the waters off the point, the shipping season may start earlier than usual this year with the Sioux Locks preparing to open.
Yes, Interlake Shipping should get off to an early start this year as the Pole Lock is scheduled to open to all marine traffic at 6 p.m. March 22. That's 3 days ahead of schedule. The Sioux Locks typically reopen to traffic on March 25 following the winter closure. The steel producers requested the early opening, and James Weekly, who's the president of the Lake Carriers Association, thanked authorities for heeding the call, especially given the circumstances and for the decision to open the St. Lawrence Seaway ahead of schedule following a very mild winter. The locks officially closed after the last vessel of the 2023 season on January 6th. To undergo critical repairs and maintenance during the six-week winter shutdown. Maintenance crews performed a variety of critical tasks on the locks, including structural inspections and maintenance.
And the warmer temperatures leading to the earlier shipping season also saw another record being broken.
Yeah, the National Weather Service reported a high of 63 degrees on Tuesday afternoon, topping the previous record of 60 in Duluth that was set in 2016, and sending the non-winter of 2023-24 deeper into the record books. The normal high for March 12 is 35 degrees. It was the second straight day Duluth experienced a record high temperature. Temperatures hit 66 in Ashland on Tuesday afternoon, 65 in Superior, and it entered the upper 50s and 60s at most reporting stations across the region. Duluth's average daily temperature so far in Duluth is 34 degrees, and that's 11 degrees above normal, following the warmest December to February meteorological winter on record in Minnesota. But don't put your parka away quite yet. High temperatures are forecast to reach only into the 30s early next week.
Well, Maria, Northland College isn't the only educational institution in the region facing a budget crunch. The Superior School District announced it's laying off 25 teachers.
That's correct. The Superior School Board has discussed preliminary non-renewal notices. They did that on March 4th during the Committee of the Whole meeting. And the final notices to teachers whose contracts are not going to be renewed will be approved this coming Monday, March 18th. The move is one of many difficult decisions the district is making due to budgetary restrictions. The state has Superior capped at one of the lowest per pupil amounts in the state. And they also have seen declining enrollment. They've lost about 500 students since the 2019-2020 school year. budget issues have led to them deciding to close down Lake Superior Elementary School at the end of this year. And they've had to make some significant changes in the budget, particularly because they will lose all of the federal pandemic ESSER funds. That money all has to be spent by September of this year.
Well, also concerning the schools, there's competition to lead the district, with six candidates filing for three Superior School Board positions.
That's right. Of all of the races going on in Douglas County this April, that is probably the most hotly contested. There's six contestants for three seats. One of the contestants is currently serving the remainder of Stephen Stupak's term. He resigned from the board back in August, and in September, Nick Olson was appointed into his position to serve those last few months. Another one of the candidates has served previously. Laura Gapsky served 6 years on the board, two terms, from 2017 to 2023. And the rest of them are newcomers, but many of them are names people may have heard before because they have stepped up to apply to take over the remainder of terms for three board members who resigned this year.
Well, it's not too early to plan for the 4th of July. In Lake Nabagamon, a nonprofit is stepping forward to make sure the fireworks can go off.
That's right. So the Nabagamon Community Association has been in charge of the 4th of July festivities in Lake Nabagamon for a long time. And the village can trace its 4th of July celebration back to 1898, but that was before the Community Association. The Community Association has some new board members who took over earlier this month after they found out that a lot of the older board members stopped having meetings and they were just basically burned out. But the new group has stepped forward. They're trying to collect $15,000 by March 15th in order to make sure that they can order the fireworks in time so that the 4th of July will have fireworks in Lake Nabagamon.
All right. More power to the new group. And yes, you can't have fireworks if people are burned out. We've been speaking with Maria Lockwood, reporter for the Superior Telegram. Thank you, Maria.
Thanks, Robin.
And Rick Lubbers, executive editor of the Duluth News Tribune. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks, Robin.
You can stay updated on these stories and all the regional news anytime at WPR.org, SuperiorTelegram.com, and DuluthNewsTribune.com. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. We leave you with more of the music of Morning Bird. I'm Robin Washington. Stay safe, everyone.
Take me back to the land that I know.
Thunder.
Soak the ground once the flowers grow.
Thunder.
Cool the earth and calm my soul.
Thunder.
Down my cheeks the water rolls.
Thunder.